Hello. Hello. Are you there? Speak to me. I'm on StreamYard. Ecat, you can see me? All right. How about those of you in the chat here? I just came on a little early just to say hello and also to make sure that everything's working. Testing, testing. Yeah, the mic's working. All right, Corky, how you doing? Infidel, apostate? Yes, we're working. Well, I got a minute or so. Let me see if I can play with the... Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm getting ready for my high school friend on Thursday. That's Howard Wilson, who I'm going to be inviting into this StreamYard room. And we're going to talk about the late, great Johnny Carson and the Tonight Show. And while we're waiting here, I'm going to start at 3, but we can just chit-chat in the meantime. Henrietta Simon, welcome. Super Java Bean, thank you. Guada 71, I don't know if I'm pronouncing your name correctly. Diana Pollux, N4 Medusa, 22, Spiritual Compass, Ecat, hi. How you doing? Super, okay, so we've got Super Java Bean. And great, looks like everything's going well today. Let me get my notes out. You're going to be astounded, just as I was, in what you're about to hear about Anthony Bourdain. It's warming up out here. I don't know if you can hear it, but I have a little bit of a fan going on. It's too noisy. I'll have to turn it off and just sweat for an hour. Steve, you, hello, Prof. Alexis Miller, are you sure you're in the right channel here? South Pole Breakaway Civilization. That sounds like YouTube fare, along with the aliens are there. We'd be so lucky if the aliens came down and invaded us. It's much preferable. Not just a little bit of background noise. Okay, it's good. There are two live streams going. Oh, interesting. I think there might be on one on StreamYard and one on YouTube. I'll go with the YouTube one and check that later. As long as there's no stream going on, I'm okay. But thank you, Michael, for letting me know. Yeah, hopefully next, by this Thursday, I'll be able to put some clips in. That's why I want to use StreamYard, not only to bring in the guest, but also to be able to use clips. All right, it's 3 o'clock. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Professor Hamamoto, and I welcome you back. I was on leave, on hiatus, involuntarily, of course, last week, and I'm glad that you have rejoined me today. And I did record a couple of shows last week, but they might be a little bit more difficult to find. I have them on record, though. I like to keep up the momentum. This is all part of this larger book project that I'm working on. And Anthony Bourdain is certainly going to make a chapter, maybe even two. So let's launch right into it, ladies and gentlemen. Again, welcome. I'm so pleased that you're here today. And I've been looking into Chef Anthony Bourdain since around 1918. Now, like most of you, I knew about him years earlier. I caught wind of him when he was on the Food Network. Can you believe that? That nothing cable television network called the Food Network. And he was one of the early presences there. And he got bigger and bigger and bigger. And of course, when the books hit, he became even much more of a superstar in the media firmament. And CNN picked him up. And he was on CNN from, according to my notes, 2013 all the way to 2018 when he met an unfortunate death. And this unfortunate death is going to be a good deal of the focus today, right? And that was the show, as you know, Parts Unknown. And I am going to take you into some unknown parts of Anthony Bourdain's world. And some of it you know about, but I'm going to be combining with what you know and what I knew coming into this with what I was able to detect from his autobiographical writings. And I did look at a lot of YouTube interviews and was able to piece together some information here. And like you, I was astounded when I learned of his death back in June 8, 2018. And Bourdain's death was fresh on my mind when I went to a trip to Vietnam. And as you know, the whole premise of Parts Unknown is that Anthony Bourdain goes to all these different countries. And toward the end, I think he finished up in the U.S. I think his last show was in the Lower East Side of New York. But he went all over the world in some places that even the most intrepid, experienced travelers would dare not tread. And that, ladies and gentlemen, should be a red flag to you. And I'll explain what I mean by that cryptic remark presently. I was invited to Vietnam by a colleague of mine over at UC Davis, Professor Kyu Linh Valverde. She is Vietnamese-American. She's fluent in Vietnamese. And she's somewhat of a national icon, I won't say hero, but she's nationally known throughout the country because of the specials she's done. And I I'm half serious about this. It's not too late. I have thrown the idea past. Hey, I said, why don't we film an Anthony Bourdain type show? But instead of doing food, we'll do fashion all over the world, show how different countries, second world, developing countries, produce clothing, shoes, footwear in a way that Anthony Bourdain could not even fathom. Because he was, after all, when you get down to it, he was an accidental tourist, if I can borrow the name of another film that you might want to cross-reference. Okay, I'm getting a feed here from the live chat, so I guess you're still with me. I took a photo in my apartment. I stayed for about around 3 months in Da Nang, which is in central Vietnam. First time ever in Vietnam for myself. And I understand what Anthony Bourdain meant when he said that he felt right at home there. I felt the same sensation. As soon as I got out of the airport, because all airports pretty much are the same, right? But as soon as I stepped out of the airport, I felt that huge blast of, and it was nighttime, it was like midnight or something, felt that huge blast of heat and humidity. I said, home, because I've lived in Japan previously. I lived in Okinawa, and the weather is very similar. And the fauna and the flora is very similar. So I felt instantly at home, which kind of surprised my colleague, Kyu Linh Valverde, but said, hey, it's really great here. So I understand that sensation, and I really take delight in that, his ability to share, Bourdain's ability with his good writing, great writing skills, I'd say. He's a good writer. I don't think all of it was his writing, which I'll get to in a moment, but he was a really keen observer for the people who did finally put his thoughts down on paper and publish them in book form. Yes, he's one of my conclusions. They're going to get better and better, so hang on. One of my conclusions is that Anthony Bourdain was like most New York Times bestsellers. He was a synthetic author. And that's a concept I've developed to apply to people such as Joseph Heller, who came out of the advertising world. He was a madman. Remember that show, Mad Men? And J.D. Salinger, people like that. In the post-war, well, actually in the 30s and 40s, they're already starting to become these synthetic writers. George Plimpton was. By the way, that I'm not just talking. This has been well documented in books such as this that are being to come out to show how U.S. intelligence were involved in shaping, developing, subsidizing what passes for American arts and letters, a literature, in other words. So I put Bourdain in this tradition, this grand, ignoble tradition. And we see that in popular literature in Britain. We see Harry Potter, right? J.K. Rowling, she's a synthetic writer. The woman that did, we've talked about this before, but just as a, so I can contextualize Anthony Bourdain in this framework here. We see this, The Hunger Games, the person, the lady who wrote that, and on and on. I'm reading Anne Rice right now. She seems to be real. She seems to be legit, but I might be mistaken. There's a Canadian subject by the name of Margaret Atwood. She has all the hallmarks of a synthetic writer. I think she's fed a lot of British intelligence to put into her futuristic fiction, some of which have, of course, made it right into Netflix. Her brother, by the way, Margaret Atwood, is a prominent neuroscientist who she credits. And that's a giveaway. That's a tell right there. So you see, ladies and gentlemen, even these, you know, we know about movies and television shows. Everybody talks about, oh, yeah, we're being programmed and all this so knowingly. But it's much more extensive than you think. It's so, and now we're being programmed at the genetic level. Wow. Wow. That's the final frontier, as the saying or the phrase went in Star Trek. Isn't that Star Trek? Yeah, even Gene Roddenberry was hanging out with that group of nine, right? That cult that he came out of. He was an obscure writer. He was a nobody. He was on his last legs, you know. And they said, Gene, we're going to make you into a star. We're going to give you something, a franchise called Star Trek. And we're going to use you as a vehicle to metaphysically pre-program the entire world. We'll start with the U.S. and the Brit, you know, the English-speaking world, and you'll become a worldwide phenomenon. Do you understand where I'm going with this? So if our literature is being programmed, then why not our food? Why not our food? Why not our sustenance, right? We know about GMOs, but do we really? Do we really understand? So anyway, I'm getting ahead of myself. I packed Kitchen Confidential, the New York Times bestseller, and it doesn't get to become a bestseller unless it goes through this process that I alluded to. I packed that along with a book, coincidentally enough, on the Amanda Knox murder investigation. Remember that one? Just for your information, I think it's the best one of the three or four or five main books on Amanda. She's the American, it was an exchange program, but it was an overseas program. If you're a parent of a university level or high school student, be very, very careful about sending your kids overseas to one of these programs, all right? Just do your due diligence. I know it looks good on their resume and it might help them in a job interview in the future, but you don't want them to wind up in an Amanda Knox situation, all right? But that's not today's talk. That's perhaps some other time. But this book is by Nina Burley, who, by the way, is fluent in Italiano, and she's lived there for a number of years, and I think that brings her a great deal, and she knows the culture, and she has a great deal more credibility in my book. The book, very quickly, is called The Fatal Gift of Beauty, The Trials of Amanda Knox, 2011. So you can see the motif here, right? Because this was August 2018, and Bourdain had died only a couple months before in June. It was still fresh in my mind. And this was before, ladies and gentlemen, that I understood a little bit more about his relationship with Asia Argento, or if you prefer, Asia Argento, if you say it in American English. And I had not yet found out that her father was a film director in Italian, Franco-Italian. There's different funding sources from different national groups. And I think a lot of the funding comes from intelligence sources. Just to say in passing, like a lot of film, by like a lot of media, it's almost just like big media, big tech is synonymous, if not just a one arm of the national security state, the national intelligence state. So that's her father. And this is before I knew more about her. And I started looking over the years since 2018. I started looking at the films like Suspiria and some of the other films that have been released in the U.S. Most of them are just awful. They're garbage. And it looks like more like an exercise in money laundering than some serious attempt at cinema. That's just my own. Siskel and Ebert, remember those guys? I don't think they were on the take. Maybe they were, who knows? And reading about Anthony Bourdain's life, it seems like there's all these freeloaders and spongers, most of them who are critics and now bloggers, who can almost live on all the freebies and swag bags that they get. In addition to the spies and the grifters and the players and the machers and the intelligence assets and the money launderers and high-level drug dealers and human traffickers that go through this world. Of course, he doesn't talk about that. He talks about Anthony Bourdain, doesn't talk about. He talks about the poor Guatemalan illegal immigrants that work in the kitchens. And yeah, I feel sorry for them. I worked with them myself. I started my first legal job as a 16-year-old was as a dishwasher, and it was nothing but Mexican immigrants. All right, and I was with them. So I feel you, Anthony. I never got to be a. I did some prep work in the back. For Joe, who was also Mexican, by the way, he allowed me to do some salad prep and all that. I was not really enthralled by the kitchen life. I just did it to earn my $1.65 an hour paycheck. Plus, they gave you a free meal, or maybe you can sneak another one out before you went home. That was part of the pay, and they deducted 50 cents out of your paychecks for a meal. Pancake House, right across the street from Anaheim. The original Disneyland was called Sambo's. That name would not fly these days. But anyway, I didn't want to talk about my experience on the line, as Bourdain calls it. So I brought these books there, and I started digging into it. I read both books while I was there, and I left them with my friend Q Ling. And I will state at the outset of this talk that I never bought in to the cable TV persona of Bourdain. Yes, in Food Network, yeah, I saw it as credible because Food Network was nothing as it is today. It was just kind of a throwaway. They kind of built it up. And I thought, they can get any jerkwad and put them on Food Network and it would be fine. I didn't really seriously look at it. I thought he was pretty cool, but didn't really take him that seriously. But when he hit CNN, I said, what do have we here? Because, ladies and gentlemen, I have some prior experience with synthetic chefs like Anthony Bourdain. Again, I'll reiterate that I figured that once Kitchen Confidential, that became a New York Times bestseller, once that came in, Bourdain already had working for him, or his agents or his people had working for him, a whole stable of ghostwriters, bunch of editors who synthesize his notes, his post-it notes, stuff like this, his scrawlings, his pads, his notepads, his drunken ramblings on tape recorders that leaves around bits and pieces, right? And they whipped it into a book. And, I'm a writer. I know what it takes in order to produce even half readable prose. And he gives away, in fact, the second book, this one here, is kind of a cleanup of the first book to try to explain some inconsistencies or questions that might come to the minds of skeptical people like myself. And his whole writing method of being in a taxi cab, scrunched up after a night of 12 hours on the line of working, having a drink in mid-shift, and then a couple of drinks after work, and then scrunching up in his cab and scrawling some notes before he got back to his apartment, waking up 3 o'clock in the morning and doing some writing before he had to wake up early. You know, that didn't ring true, right? It doesn't ring true that some construction guy can come up with a book called, Strange Doings in Laurel Canyon, right? I'm a writer. I know what it takes. Not to say that these people don't have writing skills, but I'm saying that they had help. Why did they have help, and to what end were they being helped? That's really the question that I'm going to be answering today. So I've had some experience here about synthetic writers. I should tell you that at UC Davis, I was acquainted with its food studies program. It's a department. It's a whole research area. It's probably one of the largest in the country, in the U.S., if not the world. And it's funded by any number of foundations, including the Mars candy bars. I think I've talked about this before. They're a big contributor, and on the wine companies. And you know about the Mondavi Center, right? The Mondavi wine people. They built an entire concert hall on the UC Davis campus. So they're very big in food culture and enology, you know, wine technology. And to their credit, they helped to build what is now the California wine industry, multi-million dollar, if not billion dollar industry by now. So that, you know, I come from those roots. Not only that, but UC Davis produced its own celebrity chef long before Anthony Bourdain was even dreamed up by some sort of literary agent or by some food network. He was a guy who, by his own admission, was smoking a lot of dope, and he was a heroin addict. Another reason why I'm skeptical about his, I know he read a lot, it's, you can tell. But so far as writing, being a heroin addict doesn't really lend itself to focus and concentration that's required of writing. And that's him saying this, Anthony Bourdain. But long before Anthony Bourdain was even discovered, quote unquote, or found or cultivated or put up as a front, there was a guy named Martin Yan. Remember him? Y-A-N, Martin Yan, as in Yan can cook. Yeah, Yan can cook, me can cook. Yeah, something fishy here. By the way, I'm using the chopstick language because Yan speaks perfect English. That was an affectation just to satisfy the Mr. Miyagi, Charlie Chan segment of the PBS people who think they're sophisticated and well travel, but they still want to hear a Chinaman talk like a Chinaman. So Martin Yan talking Chinese language. And that started in PBS, stands for Petroleum Broadcasting Service, in 1982. This is, you know, Bourdain was, well, he had graduated from cooking school, which I'll talk about in a moment. But he was out there working his way up through the ranks. He wound up at Les Halles as the executive chef eventually before he was plucked out of the ranks and made into an international media star to the point where he could even command $40,000 a month by putting his name on some restaurant down South Beach. And all he had to do for his money was show up every once in a while. Hey, isn't South Beach, isn't down there, isn't that kind of known for a certain type of industry that high rollers are known to blow their money into casinos and high-end restaurants? Oh, gosh, yeah. That's probably purely coincidental. And by the way, I have no class envy. You put any kind of home cooked meal in front of me, stew, home cooked meal, I'm happy with that. Soul food, whatever it is. My mother was not a great cook, but I've had some really good meals at people's homes, and I'm perfectly fine with that. In fact, that's what I prefer. So that's Jian Can Cook, and he comes right out of UC Davis. He came out with a Master of Science degree in 1975, Martin Yan, in food science. And that's why PBS brought him in to kind of ease China, the idea and the reality of the Chinese century into the investing public that pretends to like PBS, right? It's all part of the larger psychological operation that's required for the gradual takeover and the subversion of one seemingly enemy society with the U.S. actually there together. This whole notion of that the Chacoms are responsible for everything that's going on in America is a mythology from intelligence assets. The truth is that they're joined at the hips, and they've been that way since probably the late 20s and the 30s, or probably maybe even earlier, maybe when the first Rockefellers start showing up in China. Or, about the opium trade. It started very early on. So this notion that the Chacoms are there and we're over here and they're the enemy. Well, that's just good old-fashioned race baiting. We've heard that before. So Martin Young was very instrumental in transforming UC Davis, which is the ag school for the University of California, as I mentioned before. It turned UC Davis and other institutions into the PRC-friendly institutions that it has become, largely through the assistance of the former chancellor. She was forced to retire before they were able to successfully push me out. I retired as well. Of course, her compensation package was on a magnitude several times more than mine, but the point is she dropped before I did, even though she wanted it the other way around. That's Chancellor Linda P.B. Katehi. I never miss the opportunity to speak her name when talking about these types of issues that deal with the underside of the collegiate world. So she's part of that. We can talk about that later. That's Jan. So it came to me as not too much of a surprise when I heard that Anthony Bourdain had committed suicide. And I was therefore really primed to check more deeply into the circumstances surrounding his death. And most of you know, perhaps not as much as me, because I've downloaded all the articles, all the academic articles about autoerotic asphyxiation. There's a huge literature on it. I'm not just looking at other YouTube channels, and I'm not just looking at other websites, right? Like I told you before, ladies and gentlemen, what you're seeing here is far more upstream than what you're used to. So again, please don't compare me to Robert Seyfarth or whoever else you're enamored of. Gosh, I'm sorry. I'm only poking fun at someone that told me that his presentation skills are far better than mine. Oh, really, honey? Is English your second language? Is that why? I don't know. Anyway, you get my point. That's all the ranting I'm going to do on that. So as of the 5th of this month, I finished reading this book, Medium Raw, A Bloody Valentine to the Food, the World of Food and the People Who Cook, 2011. I finally caught up to it. Something told me I needed to complete the story on Anthony Bourdain, and I'm so glad that I did, because, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to drop some revelations on you, some heavy revelations. Let me check the chat room. Are you still there? Yes. Okay. Quinoa. You're eating quinoa? That's really good stuff. It's better than instant ramen, that's for sure, which I'll get to. I'll get to instant ramen in a moment. You're going to be astounded. So listen to me, all right? You're going to be, I'm amused in advance for what I'm about to tell you. And this was the follow-up to Kitchen Confidential. And again, I read the book, and even less do I buy this oft-repeated legend that Bourdain told in any number of book promo tours. I saw a lot of them on YouTube, right? And all the different interviews, I just don't buy the legend that he tells on himself, that he began his media superstardom just sort of accidental. He's the accidental chef. At age 44, after 28 years of being on the line at these haute cuisine eateries, you know, he ended up as the executive chef at La Salle. And I know he was aching, you know, he's 44 years old, and he had been married a couple times, I think. And I think he was just on the verge of fatherhood, and you know, he needed money. He'd never had a savings account, never had any sort of medical plan. And he's an advocate of that. And so am I. I think everybody should have at least some access to affordable medical care. We can argue what form that would take, but that's not the subject of today's talk. And here's the story that didn't ring true with me that comes out of Medium Raw, is that he was passing by one of those little kiosks on the street that we used to see not long ago, where you have your local free paper. Like in LA, there was the LA Weekly, the LA Village View, and I've written for those, by the way, the Orange County Weekly in San Francisco. There's a couple of them, and you know, they used to be pretty much accessible. And I, like I say, I've written for them as well because I'm a writer and I wanted to get certain information out there, but that's another story. So I know what he's talking about. And he said, hey, I'm going to write, he was in a pissed off mood as he often was. He says, I'm going to write a little article that's a tribute to all the hardworking Joes or Jose's in the kitchen back there on the line. So he did, and he took it to a friend over to one of these, they're called throwaways. And, you know, I don't mean that in a disparaging term, but it means it's a free paper. And the model is they sell by advertising, and there's a lot of escort services in the back of the magazine and retailers and all that, so they can give away the paper, and there's some editorial content, restaurant reviews, of course, all of that. You're probably familiar with the format. I liked it. I enjoyed reading those papers when they came out. I'd go to the coffee shop and look through them. And I'd even read the features. Some of them here, the Sacramento News and Review was pretty good, and they even hired Gary Webb, right, of Dark Alliance fame for a while. He was writing for that paper. And so there can be some good features in those papers. And so I'm not denigrating the paper as such, but I'm skeptical of the fact that Bourdain claims to have dashed off an article in tribute to all the guys in the back room sweating away. And I've been there. I know what it's like. I used to come back filthy, and I'd have to take like a 2 or 3 hour nap just to recover from an 8-hour shift. And I was soaking wet and stinky and smelly and all of it from all the food. I was a busboy and dishwasher. So, and then here's the part that strains credulity. They would not run the paper or the article. They kept on bumping it for, you know, they needed the space, or they needed to, they sold another article, space for a porn shop, you know, in Times Square before it went family friendly. So they had to bump his article. So he got frustrated, and, he asked his mother about it, and she's in some other context, I read that she was a literary agent, or she was with a publisher. And then later on, like here or somewhere else, I read that she was a copy editor at the New York Times, and she was in her 80s. So what story, you know, what's the real story? I think she was connected somehow to a publisher, and she had an in, and, you know, his father had an in. He comes from a family, upper middle class media people. His father was a record executive at Columbia Records. And he talks about hanging out at the Fillmore East, which was run by Bill Graham, who ran the full Fillmore West, and going to shows, seeing the mothers of invention, right? And you know more than me about, I'm sure, Frank Zappa and whoever else is out there, right? You know, supposedly, you know, he was on some kind of, national security type of track as well. Perhaps so, who knows? I don't know if this follows this pattern or not. So anyway, these are sort of incidental, not incidental, but these are facts that I'm sifting through my mind as I was reading Medium Raw. And I also read a reference to the person that he claims is his best friend in the world. His name is Eric Ripper, and he's the owner executive chef at Le Bernardin, which supposedly, according to Bourdain, you know, and I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, he knows food better than I do, right? Or at least he pretends he does. I think I know more about Japanese food or Vietnamese food than he does, but not at the connoisseur level, not at the Jiro dreams of sushi level, but just the everyday type of consumer type, you know, salaryman type of working class type of food. All right. But anyway, his friend, Eric Ripper, I ordered his autobiography. I'm not going to get to the end of the month. So I'm still on this track. And the one thing that Ripper has in common with a lot of these people who rise to the top of executive chefdom is that they were abused as children. They were traumatized, as the phrase goes. And even though Bourdain claims that he had a happy childhood, I suspect that it wasn't his peaches and cream, a New Jersey suburb type of childhood as he likes to portray it. And that remains to be seen, right? So I'm just kind of tipping you off into further, looking for further research. So I'll let you know what Eric Ripper has to say about his friend in his autobiography, which I have on order. And it was his best friend, according to Bourdain himself, Ripper, that found Anthony Bourdain in his bathrobe with the cord, the belt wrapped around his neck in his hotel room in Strasbourg in France. Right, this is Ripper himself. And by the way, as soon as his friend died, Ripper, his own, well, he was already a well-known chef. He was the executive chef, the owner, part owner of Le Bernardin, right? But his star rose. And I'm not saying that he killed his friend and so that he can go through the ranks. But there's a whole range of people who are waiting in the rings. Waiting in the wings if your boy or girl starts to go sideways, right? I gave a talk on Robin Williams, right? And if you go sideways by start going in on the military-industrial complex or start making these off-color jokes about child molestation, well, you know, maybe it's time to exchange him for Adam Sandler or somebody. And I mentioned in passing the death of David Kung Fu Carradine, who died of supposedly of autoerotic asphyxiation. Supposedly, it's said that Robin Williams might have died along those same lines. And it's said that Anthony Bourdain died in the same manner, right? How coincidental is that? I'll address that topic later. And I won't bore you with all the different articles that I've found that describe the phenomenon, even giving you all the different types of statistics and rundown just very quickly. It's very rare that anybody commits autoerotic asphyxiation or commits suicide in general when they're nude. It's even more rare for women to do it. They absolutely don't do it. And it's not, it's mostly men who do it, but it's not always men. In the case of the designer Kate Spade, who was only 55, she died supposedly of asphyxiation, hanging with a red scarf. I don't know of her design or not. It's still being speculated. It was known, though, that she was, I think, if not in litigation, she was threatening to try to reclaim her name, the Kate Spade brand. By the way, her brother-in-law is the comedian David Spade, and her husband was instrumental in building that business up to the brand that it became. So anyway, these are all examples of curious strangling by death types of scenarios that we've seen more than once in times past. Now, speaking of sexual traumatization, usually it's homosexual rape. And I've spoken previously about the Bloomsbury Group and about the sculptor who contributed, well, he was paid for it, but he's the artist behind the sculpture that's the centerpiece of the BBC Broadcasting House that glorifies man-boy love. What's his name? Eric Gates or Eric Gale or Cameron, Eric something, whatever. You know, it has to do with this man-boy love, intergenerational love, homosexual rape scenario. And we also see that in the case of the chef. He never became a celebrity chef like the person he helped bring to prominence, Alice Waters, of a Mamasson, right? Is that what it's called in Berkeley? She's credited Alice Walker. And by the way, Bourdain really goes in on Alice Walker in this book. He hates her. And with good reason, you know, I agree with his assessment. But it was Jeremiah Tower that brought California cuisine to national and perhaps international prominence. He was a definite student of food cultures, not just in the U.S., but primarily in Europe and partly in Asia and regionally within the United States, including California, right? That's Jeremiah Tower. But there was a documentary on Jeremiah Tower. What was it called? I can't remember. Gosh, I had it written down someplace. But there's a film documentary. It's on YouTube. Just look up Jeremiah Tower. And he talks about how he was abused when he was a schoolboy in Britain. His parents were bourgeois. They had independent money, and they'd go on these sea cruises. They would take him along. But they dumped him off at one of these English public schools, boarding schools, where he was relentlessly humiliated and tortured and raped and all that. And we also, in coming across some of the figures that Bourdain writes about, people like David Chang, Korean American. He's the head of Momofuku Ko, is his signature restaurant. He has these other spinoffs too. I haven't been to any of these places. I was trying to think, have I even ever been in a 5-star restaurant? I think I have, but they really didn't register with me. I went to Mamasson in the bar. I think I was there. They wouldn't give me a reservation, you know, even though I had a Jack and tie. I guess I didn't fit the profile. I didn't look like a Silicon Valley mogul or, you know, someone else of importance. Or I didn't come up on the facial recognition technology, which I think they have at these elite restaurants. That's just a guess. But anyway, David Chang is he devotes a long chapter to him, so it's very interesting to me. And he's a guy that suffers from these massive, unexplained headaches, and he talks of the whole chapter on Chang. Starts with, he said, "Dude, I just got a spinal tap. I thought I was having a brain hemorrhage. It was so bad." And he has these bouts of hysterical deafness where he can't hear anything, and he's perpetually in torment. And Bourdain ascribes it or attributes to the fact that he was a religious studies major in college, and that he comes out of a devoutly Christian Korean-American family, and they can be very, very devout. You know, from what I've been able to see in Christianity, you know, especially the evangelical sort. So that's how he sees it. But I'm not, you know, I'm not so sure whether Chang is also a product of this sort of sexual traumatization, like a lot of these chefs who are typically very temperamental, abusive, physically threatening, and some of them suicidal, you know, ideations and all that. I mean, they're not happy people in general. And Chang is of Momofuku is described as an angry, conflicted individual. And he feels guilty about it. I think he was being interviewed for the Shaft. He was not even 40. I think he was like 34, 35 years old. And he had already been acclaimed as the second coming of Anthony Bourdain, right? Or someone like him. Bourdain never claimed to be such a great chef. He claims to be just an executive chef who became a food journalist that we know today. But let me explain what's behind the phenomenon of momofuku. Momofuku, spelled M-O-M-O-F-U-K-U. And what it is, ladies and gentlemen, I'm telling you here, and I don't think even Anthony Bourdain knew this. I know it because I'm a student of Japanese popular culture, right? I'm interested in Pokemon, for example, Pokemon Go, and anime, and cosplay, and all, and Japanese video games, and Japanese electronics, right? Sony, all of that stuff, right? And their food culture. So I kind of understand it. And David Chang, his restaurant is called Momofuku Ko, and Ko means child, right? Child of Momofuku. But who was Momofuku? Well, let me tell you who Momofuku Ando was. He was born in 1910 in Taiwan. It was occupied by Japan, Imperial Japan at the time. So he's Taiwanese Japanese, but a Japanese citizen, right? Ando Momofuku, born 1910, lived to 2007. He lived a pretty long time for someone who, you know, ate the way he, I guess I'm sure he ate fresh, good food. But it was Momofuku Ando who founded Nissin Foods after World War II. A good deal of the Japanese population had no food. Remember, or you might not remember, but you might have read that all the bombing of Japan that was meant to incinerate the civilian population and its infrastructure, courtesy of people like Arnold, Hap Arnold, right? So they had to come up with a food that was widely available to the public, make it cheaply and fast, and have a minimum level of nutrition. Even though initially it was expensive, the price came way down. Today it's very cheap. So what did Nissin Foods produce after World War II due to this food crisis? He developed, not David Chang, but Momofuku Ando, he developed instant ramen. So the elite celebrity chef David Chang, who came up with the signature restaurant, he came up. I'm sure it's a psyop, and it's a joke, and it's an insult, and it's a taunt of all the jerkwads that spend $800, you know, for a meal and wine or whatever at Momofuku Ko. It's a joke on those people, and it's an inside joke upon the people who put Chang up there in this position, saying, you know what, you're eating child of instant ramen that we gave to the Japs after World War II. And since he's Korean-American, I'm sure there's no love lost between him and the Japanese people. You know, his parents might have come out of the deprivation of the Korean War, the unknown war, where the U.S. again bombed Korean civilians. So the whole Korean and Korean-American boner towards Japan needs to be shared with another nation called the United States of America. So that's really where Momofuku comes from. Momofuku comes from instant ramen. And here you go, ladies and gentlemen. I have my supply. I ate one of these the other day, and I came up with a whopping headache. Even though there's no MSG in it, it tastes like chemicals, right? And then here's a Korean version. This is like a soba, yakisoba. You make the noodles, you put this flavoring in there, and you fry it up. A friend gave me a couple of these. I haven't dared try it, and I'm probably gonna just throw it out. I might keep it though, because you know I might need it when the economy really tanks, but I have some other provisions that I have for that purpose. And of course, those of you who have been to college or have been working, jobs where you can't really take time to eat, right? Because you need to be on the clock or there's no provision. You grew up on instant ramen. You grew up on cup of noodles. You grew up on a cup of ramen, whatever it's called. I mean, I used to eat that stuff. And even today, most the students I knew, they used to compete and brag about, what was the cheapest you ever paid for ramen? You know, it's not like at 50 cents or whatever it is. You know, it's really cheap. It's bad. It's bad news. It's bad stuff, as you might imagine. But ramen, instant ramen, and there's an article that validates my hunch, but it says that instant ramen did a great deal to help bring Japan out of the post-war doldrums, because of its infrastructure being wiped out, to the economic miracle that it became starting around, let's say, the early 60s and mid 60s, when all that CIA money was coming in and they were starting new wars in Vietnam and other parts of the world. A lot of it was being funneled through Japan. They were able to rise because of this intelligence connection there. So Momofuku was probably part of that as well. And then, of course, it migrated to the U.S. in the form of cup of noodles, and it became, at the other end of the spectrum, a elite eatery, haute cuisine, run by celebrity chef David Chang. So spread that around to your friends. Momofuku Ko comes from Momofuku Ando, the guy who invented instant ramen. Okay, that's not the biggest revelation I have for you today, ladies and gentlemen. It gets better. And I'm going to time it so it concludes right at 4 o'clock, right? Because I know you have to get to dinner, and so do I. I'm going to have some green curry, Thai curry, for dinner with some sweet sticky rice. I found a new place that makes it all fresh. It's good. But hey, this should be a tell for you and for us. And it came to me kind of late. And I met a person who graduated from this very same culinary institute. It's known as the best in the United States of America. And this is where Bourdain graduated. It's called the Culinary Institute of America. The Culinary Institute of America. What are the initials of the Culinary Institute of America? Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the initials are CIA. Is this a tell or what? Or is it just a matter of me bugging out? Right? Because I'm so attuned to CIA this, CIA that, you know, I watch all the YouTube and read all the conspiracy sites that everything is a conspiracy, everything's CIA, everything's Bill Gates, everything is the Rothschilds and the Rockefellers. Maybe, you know, I'm one of those people going around, you know, as they say, when all you got is a hammer, everything's a nail. Maybe I'm one of those guys, you know, maybe I'm one of those people who see a Momofuku under, you are a chakam under every bed, you know. But I found an article that gave me the history. You know, when all else fails, turn to history, ladies and gentlemen. I found a historical piece that says that the Culinary Institute of America was founded in 1946. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, around the same time that the OSS became the permanent body we see today, the Central Intelligence Agency. They came about at the same time. And more recently, in 2005, they have a Department of Liberal Arts. Now I think they're a degree-granting, certified, accredited bachelor's. I think they might even have master's degree. The CIA, you can get a degree there. But back in the days where Bourdain was going to school there, it was primarily a vocational school, just about learning how to cook, doing all the prep work, and a darn good one from what I understand. But that does not mean that it is free of connections with the intelligence agencies, right? That requires a little bit more research so far as that's concerned. Now, what is a further tell that that leads me to believe that Anthony Bourdain was an intelligence asset. Well, other than the fact, as I alluded to earlier, that he was able to get in parts of the world that Blackwater would fear to tread. I'm sure when he went there, they had Blackwater mercs or some security people who were there protecting him and the crew. And I'm sure he had State Department protection and permission and clearances and United Nations and NATO, all of it was cleared before Anthony Bourdain would go to places like Myanmar or to the Congo, right? And part of the reason for him going there is to share intelligence, to gather intelligence, to transmit information, but also to kind of normalize these areas for domestic consumption for those of us who think we're just watching an adventurous cooking show led by a fascinating individual who's into the people of these exotic societies and are trying to learn their food ways. Well, if you think I'm being sarcastic, you're picking it up correctly. One of his predecessors, Anthony Bourdain, not saying that he was ever CIA, I'm just saying he was probably just an asset of the State Department or some intelligence agency. Maybe he was a double AAA, I don't know, but he worked with intelligence at some level with NATO, with the military. But one of his predecessors earned her bones in the Office of Strategic Services, which later became the CIA. And like Martin Yan, who came after her, she had a cooking show on PBS. And those of you who are old enough to remember, her name was Julia Child. Julia Child. Remember her? She couldn't cook a lick. You know, my mother would look at her and say, that lady can't cook. But she was famous for throwing, you know, food around, throwing it on the grill. I mean, I don't know how that's how, you know, line chefs operate. But it's obviously she was inept and she did not have a feel for what she was doing. But she had a cooking show. Julia Child. Yes, Piper Vogel. Remember her? She was OSS. Right. And I've already mentioned Martin Yan, and I've already mentioned Jeremiah Tower and all these characters. And at the same time, ladies and gentlemen, I started seeing within the academic world, I'd say around 2005, maybe 2005, 2010, I started seeing an uptick in the curriculum in the liberal arts area called food studies, food, you know, anthropology. I saw it being considered as an academic major. And I thought that was curious. There was one grad student I ran into who was fascinated with Trader Joe's. Gosh, I wonder what Trader Joe's was all about. Because those people were going around to foreign countries and sampling cheeses and, you know, cheap Italian wine, inexpensive wines, and polenta from all over the world. Yeah, I used to go to Trader Joe's back, I don't know. It was probably late 60s. I mean, you know, it was the original one was in Pasadena or South Pasadena, California. Now they're all over the place. The ones today bear no resemblance to the earlier ones. So it's probably, you know, who knows? I'm not going to say. But, you know, retailers, we found out Victoria's Secret, Les Wexner, retail and all these types of activities are not alien to one another. And same way, same goes with food. Although I do remember, though, when the V crisis hit last year, I tried to go to Trader Joe's. And I was going to buy some food to stock up. It's not my favorite place, but I will go there for food on occasion. And man, they really clamped down. I think there's still lines and lines around Trader Joe's in order to get in there. And they were very much part of the social science experiment, the behavioral science experiment called the Great Plandemic. The hoax is now being revealed. So anyway, let me also tip you to an illusion, something I alluded to earlier. About facial recognition technology being used at these upper-end restaurants. This is coming from Bourdain himself. He's almost just kind of indicating something. He's hinting at something. He'll never say it outright. It's up for us to to read between the lines. And page 237, he says, this is Fran Repair. Repair maintains an unofficial intelligence network that would be the envy of the CIA solely for the purpose of defending the realm. Gosh, are these not broad hints defending the realm? That's Britain, isn't it? Isn't that their language? Okay, if you are a food critic, a person of importance, anyone who could possibly hurt or impact the restaurant in a negative way, you are recognized within seconds of walking in the door. Your likes and dislikes are known. Even if you're a journalist who's never been in the restaurant but are likely to visit soon and write about it, chances are you will not, on arriving, be completely unknown quantity. Repair is an astonishingly plugged-in guy. Point is, he has to be. End of quote. So what he's implying is that the chefs have a picture board up there, and he refers to it himself, Repair. And he's usually not even in the restaurant. Anyway, he's out opening other restaurants or handing thumb drives to people in foreign countries, right, where he's got a diplomatic pass of some sort, or they've paved the way for the celebrity chef from France, or from the U.S., wherever it is. Because, you know, he's going to practice soft diplomacy by showing the food culture of country X, Y, or Z. But supposedly Repair has a photographic memory. He has all the pictures of all the different VIPs, the food journalists, and he's committed to memory and can see through their disguises, their fake mustaches, wigs, hats, whatever they wear in order to hide their identities. And he's doing that so that he can come out and meet and greet them and give them the best table and the best service and make sure that their food service is 100% perfect. Even though that's the norm of his restaurant anyway at Les Bernardins, right? So I'm thinking that this is where a lot of the early facial recognition technology was rolled out in places like New York, San Francisco, Los Angeles, because you got the high rollers, you've got the elite of the elite, and you can practice on them. And the reason why this is so beautiful is because it's got a very small network of people, right? All you have to do is connect the dots between them. And it also distracts from the common perception that it's just the average Joe that's being spied on, like you and me. Right. We always see those little pictures of people walking down the street and all the different little graphics about these strangers in parks or on the sidewalk being ID'd. But it's in places like these elite restaurants, more likely, where the technology in controlled circumstances as a laboratory was perfected. That's my hypothesis. I don't know that for sure, but reading between the lines, this is what I'm getting. Now, I'm not going to venture to guess, because I don't know for sure where Bourdain got on the bad side of his former sponsors. But I don't believe the suicide story from what I've read. And you also, you know, we've all already talked about some other suspicious deaths that supposedly were due to autoerotic asphyxiation. All I do know is that there's plenty of material in print, including the very last interview that he did with a journalist that was published, where he really goes in on Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton in general, especially where it comes to their sexual misprisions, let's put it politely, right? And this is around the time still where Donald Trump had not declared for the presidency, and it looked like Hillary Clinton was presidency bound, right? So she couldn't have, or her people couldn't really afford to have someone who had such great stature as Anthony Bourdain, who is famed for his truth-telling and being blunt and profane in doing so, couldn't really afford to have someone on that level who is loved by people the world over and everyday, you know, chefs, as well as the hoity-toity amongst us, right? Couldn't very well have someone like that slag her in public that way. Just a thought. I don't know. He offended a lot of people, so there are any number of people that could have been angry at him. We do know, however, that there was a compared to the money he was supposed to have made, it was quite a shock to a lot of people that I think he only had a little bit over $1 million in his for you or me. That's a lot of money, but for not for Anthony Bourdain or someone of his stature. You know, a little bit more than $1 million was found in his bank account. They don't know where he said it hit it. They say there's claim that he might have had some good tax arrangements, and maybe it's in other family members' names. Who knows? But he must have had his whole probate situation and his will pretty much airtight by the time he took his life, because he certainly had his income protected from the tax man by the time he died. Or maybe it was, you know, the money was kicked upstairs to whoever else it was, because he did seem to have a love-hate relationship in his books with money. He didn't feel he deserved it, didn't want it until his child came along, his daughter and his children had to provide for them. And then something kicked in where he felt that he had to earn some money after much of his adult life living on the razor's edge with very little money, no job security, and no benefits. So, ladies and gentlemen, I have a lot more material to present to you, but I'll leave it at that spot. I promise to end at the top of the hour. There's a lot more research to be done on Anthony Bourdain, and there's a lot more rethinking to do about these people we call celebrity chefs. We know that the literature people were co-opted a long time ago. We know that some medical doctors and serial killers were actually not serial killers, but cleanup artists. I'm reading a true crime book about the Hillside Strangler in LA, and that has that earmarks. And I've talked about in previous talks about a lot of cults being linked to security agencies, right? So why not celebrity chefs, right? Something to think about. Ladies and gentlemen, please share this talk. I'm sure it's going to provoke a lot of conversation. And I'll see you Thursday when we talk about Here's Johnny. Yes, Johnny Carson. We're going to talk about the Tonight Show. And I'll tell you up front, I haven't been able to find any sort of connection to him with the national security state. In fact, I think they enjoyed him to the very end. And we know for sure that he didn't die of autoerotic asphyxiation. He died of asphyxiation, yes, but it was due to emphysema. He started smoking in 1939 and never stopped, so doesn't seem much of a surprise. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it. I'm glad the stream was able to work today, and enjoy the rest of your day. Thank you so much. Peace.